Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Scott Gregory, sitting in today for Rich Fisher. Remember those incredibly valuable Chinese rhinoceros horn cups? Back in July, the popular public television program Antiques Roadshow taped a show here in Tulsa. That's when a collection of five 17th century Chinese rhino horn cups, the property of one Doug Huber, was valued by the veteran Antiques Roadshow appraiser and Asian art expert Lark Mason at $1 to $1.5 million, the most valuable item both then and now ever appraised in the history of the Antiques Roadshow program, which has been on the air for about 15 years now. The cups then went on exhibit at the Philbrook Museum of Art here in Tulsa from August to December of last year, and in November, Lark Mason himself appeared at Philbrook to talk about the discovery, the importance, and the value of those rhino cups, and while he was in town, he appeared on Studio Tulsa. Today we're listening back to that program, in which Mason talks not just about the cups, but also about his own training, connoisseurship, and long-running career as an Asian art expert and appraiser, and tomorrow, you could say that the dramatic story of those cups and their discovery comes to a close. Tomorrow is when the cups will be put up for sale at an auction at Sotheby's in New York. It's the Fine Chinese Ceramics and Works of Art Auction, which again happens tomorrow. And the cups are expected to fetch somewhere between $700,000 and $1 million. Again, art Asian expert Lark Mason is our guest today as we listen back to a program from November.
Lark Mason, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks, Rich.
And of course, the last time you were in Tulsa, a person was unearthing this box full of these just incredibly carved 17th century Chinese rhinoceros horn cups.
Indeed, they were.
Tell us about your reaction that day. I mean, you see all sorts of things on the Antiques Roadshows, everything from fakes to, you know, genuine objects. But of course, as we all know, this is the most highly appraised item ever seen on Antiques Roadshow.
It was, and it was a complete surprise. And, you know, a lot of people don't realize that the experts, the specialists who come for the show, we actually are volunteers. And so we do six different cities. That's the most that we can do over the course of the summer, each of which turns into three different shows. And on that particular day, I was not having a good day. I had not seen anything that I could see. And my colleagues, I had two other colleagues who were there with me, both of whom had already been on television and taped for the television. And so they were having a great day, and I was feeling kind of, this is not going to work out.
This is interesting. You describe it, you know, by your FaceTime on television,
exactly.
If it's a good day or not. Yeah,
exactly. But, you know, it's always a good day in the sense that you're trying to help people and you're unraveling mysteries and solving these little problems and making people have a good experience. So that, mm-hmm. that sense, it's good. But on the other end, you really want to be able to see something that's spectacular that you can share with a bigger audience and share your enthusiasm about. And so that wasn't happening for me that day. So I was feeling pretty down, and then we had our lunch break. And, you know, over the course of a day, I'll see maybe 500 people, which represents 2,000 objects. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of things. Mm-hmm. So I went off to lunch thinking, okay, this is not going to work out.
Besides, I'm in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Where am I going to find Asian art?
Exactly. There's not a whole lot of chances. I thought that the only things that have come in, that's it. And so I came back from lunch, and the first fellow who came to my table was Doug, who had the rhinoceros cups, and he opened up a package, and he took out one. And I thought, oh, my gosh, that's wonderful.
You recognize this object from the very moment he pulled it out.
I did. It's not the first rhinoceros horn cup that I've ever handled. I've handled hundreds of them in my career. And after the first one, there came another, and then they just sort of tumbled out. And so after I'm looking at five and thinking, oh, my gosh, this is really the right place at the right time, because not too long ago, these were not worth very much.
Really?
It's really a market change that's been very dramatic.
That was my next question. What makes these rhinoceros horn cups so valuable? Is it a common object? Is it a pretty rare object these days? Or is it just the market has heated up?
Well, they're extraordinarily rare, mm-hmm. first. They are very rare objects. Second, they were always considered very valuable luxury items. And they were created for drinking wine. And they were believed, the reason that they were created for drinking wine, and they had that association, goes back literally thousands of years in China, because the Chinese, as early as 3,000 years ago, We have bronze vessels that were made to hold wine in the shape of rhinoceros. And the Chinese actually had tame rhinoceros, believe it or not.
Wow. Uh-huh.
Which I can't imagine, but we have models of them with saddles on their back. Can you imagine riding a rhinoceros?
Not really.
So these were wine vessels that would actually hold wine. And we surmise that the reason that happened is because the horn cup, the horn itself has kind of a shallow interior that would have been perfect for holding something that was an alcoholic beverage, not too much of it.
Right.
As opposed to, say, an ox horn, which holds a lot of liquid, which would work for water. So if you're looking for a natural vessel shape, it's one of the few natural objects that you could use as a drinking vessel. And then when you add to that the kind of allure of it's an exotic, comes from an exotic animal, and somehow or another became associated with having someone who drank from this would have long life and good health and be protected from poison and illness.
So there's all sorts of extra,
And we know from a very early period the Chinese were seeking out rhinoceros, which were their native habitat was all over China, not hard to come by. And it was also kind of a fearsome animal, so that added to the mystique. So you can see where the wealthier people would want to have a rhinoceros horn cup to drink from.
And now, are their state pretty fragile, so they don't last 400 years as perhaps these
we don't have any. They're not. They're, I'm sure there. I don't want to say that there aren't any that exist from an early period, but they're very, very few, if any, from an extremely early period of time. The majority of the ones that we have are, in fact, drinking vessels. Mm-hmm. I'd say 90% of them, of the things one sees, are drinking vessels. And the majority of those that one sees in the market come from the 16th century through the early part of the 18th century. And they tend to be beautifully carved. And the material is a durable material. And it's one of those materials that the more you handle it, the more attractive it becomes.
And why is that? The oils from your hands?
Natural amount. All of us, all humans,
have
secrete oil.
Yeah, right.
And small amounts of oil from our skin, from our hand, is not a bad thing to transmit to another organic substance.
It becomes burnished, if you will.
It does. And it soaks into the horn. Mm-hmm. And therefore, it is a protective kind of rejuvenating factor. And it enables it to be better preserved.
So as he pulled out these five cups, I mean, what was your reaction?
Well, my reaction was, oh, my gosh, these are fantastic. This is wonderful. And they were quite good examples. Mm-hmm. And my next reaction was, I want to hear his story. So I asked where he bought them. How did he come by them, rather? And he gave me his story, which he had purchased them in the 70s. And at that point, I didn't want to share any more information because what we try to do is keep this as bright and fresh for the audience as possible.
So
my reaction is genuine.
Yeah,
I have a genuine reaction, and he does as well. So the moments that I shared with him were literally under 2 or 3 minutes. And I just requested, I said, would you mind if we shared this information with a bigger audience? And he said, no. And at that point, I asked to have a producer come, and he sat aside. And the producer came, and we had a discussion and decided that this would be a worthy thing for sharing with a bigger audience.
Obviously. Did you know the value? You put a $1 to $1.5 million value, I assume that's what, about $200,000 to $250,000 a cup.
Yeah, and they're not each worth that amount. Some are worth less than that, and some others more. Mm-hmm. But overall, the value would be right in that range. And the reason for the value, getting back, that was where our first conversation was going, but the reason for this value is they were always prized, but they lost that association with their value, their importance, that connection with the past somewhere in the 20th century, where the Chinese economy and the Chinese the number of people who were available to buy things like this that would have had an association with this and it meant something culturally to them had disappeared. And so the only people that were available to buy were people who that had the resources to buy were in the West.
Mm-hmm.
And so Americans bought them and Europeans bought them, but we didn't pay what was to us much money. So they became disassociated from their cultural connections and from the value that that culture, the Chinese culture, would have placed on them. And they became just decorative objects.
Now with the resurgence of Chinese culture,
you put them together.
Yeah, I mean,
exactly.
Chinese art,
economy, more importantly.
Chinese furniture, every aspect of Chinese culture is now valued because there is a new moneyed class.
That's exactly it. And they prize their culture and they want to have things that mean something to them, and they're buying them back. I just personally sold a group of these just a few weeks ago that was in the same range as the value of this group. And it's interesting because of the ones that I recently sold, several of them had been used as candlesticks. Again, just speaking about how we didn't know what they were, because they have these tapered bases that are hollowed out at the on the underside, and people couldn't conceive that you would ever use it as a cup. So they flipped it upside down so the spread base, the wide cup part, became the base, and the narrow part looked like a holder for a candle.
Right.
And so I think two of the five that I sold recently had been used as candlesticks.
Oh, my goodness.
And it was just full of wax.
Now, had the paraffin done any damage to them?
No. Yeah. No, paraffin did not damage it at all. But it was just, it speaks to the kind of cultural disassociation that these had gone through.
And I would think with you on Antiques Roadshow, being the Asian art specialist, that you're doing a lot of educating, because I imagine there's a lot of, I mean, there probably are people who are knowledgeable that bring in items that are knowledgeable about them or think they know the object. But I think there are a lot of people who have no clue what the value or non-value of the objects are.
That's true. A lot of the people aren't interested in the value, frankly. They're just, you know, it's something that...
Passed down from grandma and grandpa.
Passed down, unless, you know, just for example, say your parents have passed away and they left you one thing.
Mm-hmm.
And you've got this object that's been passed down and you don't know why. That they thought it was worth anything and worthy of being handed down to you as the child.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're going, gosh, I don't know why my great aunt left this to me. It doesn't seem important to me. Can you share some information? And then sometimes, you know, as I examine and I ask the questions, and this is not just me, all of us, we kind of probe, when did you get it? Tell me about the great aunt. What other information? Did she travel? Did she do this or that? We can come up with an answer, which might be, you know, it looks like this was bought around 1915. When was she married? Oh, around 1915. I have a suspicion this might have been a wedding present.
Mm-hmm. And you're really sort of filling in that backstory for them.
Exactly. And so most people want that kind of information, and the value is secondary.
Mm-hmm.
Now, other people come in and they are interested in the value. And I would say a good number of instances is where people have gone out purposely trying to find things of value, to make a discovery.
Mm-hmm.
And usually those people are disappointed.
Yeah. How big is fakery in your particular field of the objects that you see come into the Antiques Roadshow?
Well, it's kind of a...
You know, the Ming Dynasty and all, you know, you hear all these Ming Dynasty vases and things like that.
Well, the Chinese have always emulated previous generations' works.
Mm-hmm.
And so one can call it fakery, or one can call it, as we do,
loving recreation.
Loving recreations or honorific works.
Honorific, that's a good word.
Okay. So that's always been the case. And, you know, scholarship over time helps unravel those problems. And connoisseurship helps very much in the sense of, you know, you learn what the original item looks like, how it was created, what were the materials from which it was created. You put yourself in the mindset of the creator, and you try to go through and recreate that object yourself and think, does this make sense to do it this way? And you go through step by step, and if you see inconsistencies in the material, the way the painting is done, the decoration, does that make sense for this particular period of time? Usually there's something that gives it away.
Now, when you're looking at something you suspect might be an honorific piece, how much time do you spend to find those inconsistencies?
Well, it, you know, for...
Sometimes they leap out at you?
I would have to say that for those of us, and I don't count myself particularly special in this regard. I think anyone who has done this for a while can do it, mm-hmm. who's has a specialized career. I could look at something from 30 feet away that is, you know, a foot high, and generally, with one glance from a distance, I know everything about that item. And I'm not bragging. It's just because when I look at it, I'm looking at it with an informed eye.
You've seen hundreds of these objects before. You've seen authentic items and those that are not.
Right. And so all that object to me is not unlike a doctor listening to a patient's heartbeat or whatever. You know, they're all messages. And they either mesh together in a way that makes sense, or there's something about it that doesn't make sense. And when there's something that doesn't make sense, that's the point at which I pick it up and I take a closer look.
My guest today is Lark Mason. He is the Asian Art Specialist for the Antiques Roadshow. He's been a longtime appraiser and also has run iGavel, among other things. He runs a private consultancy that specializes in Asian art. And he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, before we actually talk about how you got interested in Asian art, because that really wasn't your first focus, as I understand it, but on the Antiques Roadshow, you're looking at everything from Japanese porcelain to Vietnamese art to, you know, areas beyond your connoisseur expert sort of purview. You're generalists in those areas. You're basically doing a whole continent's worth of work.
It's difficult, and I don't pretend to be a specialist in those areas. Mm-hmm. I have my area of specialization where people come and consult with me. Mm-hmm. But in terms of being a generalist, what it really means is having a pretty good understanding of the cultures, the different cultures, the different time periods, having benchmarks that one uses as guides for determining whether or not something fits within a particular period or not. So, for instance, when I see a Japanese work of art, let's just say an example of Japanese cloisonne, mm-hmm. I'm looking at that in a very different way from someone who doesn't have the kind of purposeful look that I'm giving to it. Mm-hmm. And so I'm looking at that cloisonne, which is a technique using metal with colored sand, basically silica that's been fused to a metal body separated by cloisons, which are little metal wires, and then polished to a high sheen. And typically you find these are vases or different kinds of utilitarian shapes. What I'm looking at is not just the design, I'm looking at the shape, because I know that at that time in the 1880s, when these were first being made in Japan, they were actually under the guidance of Europeans who had set the factories up, helping Japan to enter into the industrial age. Mm-hmm. And they did it not because they loved Japan. They did it because they were trying to get inexpensive exports to go to Europe where they could make money. So there's certain influences that should be present on those pieces that would be different from something that would have been exactly the same technique but made in 1920. Mm-hmm. And so I have those benchmarks. I know the colors, I know the designs, I know the shapes, and I'm not a specialist in that area where I could go into great detail about particular makers, the artisans, but I know that I have the general kind of knowledge to be able to put that in the right place. And that's what a good generalist does for whatever the subject is. And then by being able to identify that, be able to communicate that information to a specialist who would then fill in the gaps.
Mm-hmm. Now, as I was mentioning earlier, you actually sort of, I guess, got the Asian art bug later from when you started your, I guess you started as a child sort of appraising antiques and learning about antiques. And you started out in American and European fine art and decorative art, right?
I did. I was really young. My dad was in the insurance industry. My mother had a small antique shop in Atlanta, Georgia. Mm-hmm. And they would let me go with them to auctions, typically mm-hmm. on Friday night or Saturday. And every now and then I'd raise my hand. I was about 12. And I just thought that the association of an object with the past was fascinating, trying to figure out what was the motivation of the person that made this or owned it. Why did they want this?
Mm-hmm.
How was this thing created? And why does this have more value than this other kind of thing? And why are people interested in buying it?
Yeah.
And, you know,
especially when you're looking at like rustic stuff, which I would imagine there's quite a bit of
it was rustic. And a little boy, I was interested in swords and spears and things like that. But over time, I just started learning more and looking at more things. And by the time I was in college, I had my own antique shop and employed a number of friends who were college students. And my dad gave me some very wise advice when I was getting ready. I actually had finished my master's in business, undergrad in English, and he gave me some wise advice as I was interviewing for jobs. And he said, you know, you've always been really good and had an interest in art and antiques. Why don't you try to meld your interest with your career?
Mm-hmm.
I think you might be able to do it. And I actually had the common sense, good sense to listen to him, which was unusual, and applied for a year-long program with Sotheby's in London, was accepted, did that, and graduated at the top of the class, and applied for a job, or actually they offered me a job in New York as a generalist. And when I left London, funny enough, my area of that I was best at was Northern European Old Master drawings.
Mm-hmm.
And there was no opening in London nor in New York. So I interviewed for several jobs. One was to be the assistant controller, and I didn't want to do that.
No.
The other was to be an assistant in a painting department, general paintings, which would have been fine. And then the other was to be a generalist appraiser. And because I had this kind of wide background from my own antique shop and so on and been involved, that seemed to be a good fit. I did that for about 7 years. And then in the context of that, was asked quite often to go and do appraisals of Asian art and developed in kind of a generalist knowledge about Asian art. But I particularly like Chinese art, and there was an opening in the Chinese department, and they invited me to join them.
Mm.
And I did.
And you, I guess, learned everything you could about it.
I did, because it was fun.
Yeah,
that's what I would spend my days off doing. I did the same thing I did on my working days.
Mm-hmm. Now, you're also, I guess, one of your specialties is Chinese furniture.
Yes.
Tell us a little about your love for Chinese furniture. What is special about Chinese furniture?
Oh, Chinese furniture is wonderful. I mean, just from many standpoints, just purely visually, it's fantastic. The woods that are used are just incredibly beautiful, very vibrant grains, these amazing exotic rosewoods. And then the craftsmanship is of the highest quality because the rosewoods are very dense, hard woods.
Yeah, they're some of the densest woods around.
They are. And you can have very exacting cuts and very fine cuts. Then you can create joins that are just amazing that you would be difficult to do in other woods. So I was fascinated by furniture because that's one of the first jobs I had when I was in the Chinese department. No one else really wanted to deal with it. And I found that a lot of the dates that people were bandying about and that museums were using tended to be very early, 15th century, 14th century dates on furniture in museums. And from my experience, this is how life is interconnected. When I was dealing with just things in my antique shop, I realized that furniture has certain wear patterns. People use it. They drag it across the floor. They move it. They lift it. Things get broken. And I found that a lot of the furniture that was supposed to be 14th century had very little wear. And I started asking questions, and people started then asking me questions, and I started writing articles. And one thing led to another. And over time, I, among others, led kind of an effort to reevaluate this. And the dating has changed.
By how much? A couple hundred
by
years?
Hundreds of years.
Yes. Yeah, I would think so.
By hundreds of years. And there's been a lot more information. And part of that has been as a consequence of this kind of interest that I had. I was invited by the preeminent scholar in China to assist with the translation of his lifelong work on the subject. So Sotheby's gave me, I think I was the first person ever at Sotheby's to get a six-month sabbatical. And they gave me a six-month sabbatical to move to Beijing and work with alongside this great scholar and translate his book on Chinese furniture. And I did that, and then that led to another book, which I did, translated on Chinese furniture, the Qing Dynasty, of the fellow who is the most knowledgeable in China, and that subject is also a friend. And then I've done my own books and so on since then. But, you know, when you have a passion for something and you're kind of pushing the envelope and trying to figure out more about why and what was the mindset of the people that did it, then it leads to all kinds of unexpected things.
You've watched this market, Asian market, utterly transform itself. I mean, probably when you were starting, most of the collectors were Western, weren't they?
They European. Were. Absolutely. You go in a sales room at any of the major auction houses, and 70% of the audience would be Western.
Yeah. And now you've watched just this utterly flip. I mean, nowadays, a lot of the best Asian art is no longer, I mean, they still auction it in London and New York, but now it's taking place in Asia.
It is. And, you know, the art market is cyclical. Mm-hmm. So, you know, all these things flowed from China to the West over the past couple of hundred years. And it was because of the weakness of the Chinese economy. And there just simply weren't people there that could afford to pay as much money as Westerners were going to pay. And the strength of our dollar and the strength of the pound and the franc and the mark and so on, that is what made that transfer happen. Now, what's happening is those currencies are weaker, and the Chinese currency is stronger, and their economy is stronger. So they are wanting to buy back their cultural heritage, and we're seeing this great shift, and it's going the other direction.
I would imagine if a lot of American heritage had left, there would be a lot of nationalistic pride involved in bringing that back home. Is the same at play in China today?
Very much so. There is. They're very proud of their culture. They want to have their things back. But they're, you know, it's important to realize that because we have a fluid market, that it's gone one way and it's able to come back.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And had things never left China, I would dare say that a lot of them would have been destroyed, because they would have been held by people who had no appreciation for the items, because they had been no value attached to them, rather like the rhinoceros horns that were used as candlesticks. And therefore, they are treated in ways that are not appropriate, and they end up being destroyed. But because the market has valued these things so much, whether they've been in the United States or in China, they have been kept in good condition and repair and valued by people.
Well, it was a pleasure talking with you. Lark Mason, thanks very much for joining us.
Rich, loved it.
The Asian art expert and veteran Antiques Roadshow appraiser Lark Mason in conversation with Rich Fisher here on Studio Tulsa from a program that aired back in November. That's when Mason was here in Tulsa to discuss the famed collection of five Chinese rhino horn cups, which he had valued at $1 to $1.5 million at an Antiques Roadshow taping here in Tulsa last summer. The cups go on sale tomorrow at an auction at Sotheby's in New York. You've been listening to Studio Tulsa. I'm Scott Gregory, sitting in today for Rich Fisher. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next time.